Item one, we know what Janet Yellen is thinking. Item two, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, except for stories about the housing market. Item three, bourbon on the black market. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 14th of June. Today, good as always to have you along. The macroeconomic headline of this Wednesday comes to us straight from the most powerful economist in the world, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, at her post-interest rate meeting press conference this afternoon.
Overall, we continue to expect that the economy will expand at a moderate pace over the next few years.
Moderate pace there, by the way, is code Fed speak, if you will, for kind of what we have now, 2-ish% growth, maybe a little bit less. On the topic of interest rate hikes, because I know you want to know, there was one today, a quarter of a percentage point, right about what everybody had been guessing, and said Yellen there are going to be some more over the next couple of years, also what everybody had been guessing. If you want to wonk out a little bit, Yellen also said the Fed is going to start to sell off its ginormous portfolio of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds it accumulated in response to the financial crisis. The Fed has something like $4 trillion worth of them sitting on its balance sheet. The net effect will be, just like raising interest rates to make it more expensive to borrow money, one thing it will not be, Yellen admitted, is economically exciting.
As one of my colleagues, President Harker, described it, it'll be like watching paint dry, that this will just be something that runs quietly in the background.
It's like a lot of Fed policy, right? Watching paint dry. Now, one more thing, inflation. Yellen acknowledged today that prices, inflation, is running a little bit lower than where the Fed would like, which brings us to the bond market and the low, low yields on benchmark U.S. 10-year Treasury notes. If you want to know where this economy is going, as we see every now and then, bonds are the place to be. So with the Fed raising rates, but with the bond market going the other way, what gives? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that.
The return on investment for 10-year treasuries is the lowest it's been all year. That means something.
Bond investors are thinking the economy is not in any rock'em sock'em growth mode.
Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management.
And that no matter what the Fed does or doesn't do, it's not going to affect things that much.
If bond investors thought that the economy would be screaming ahead over the next 10 years, they would demand higher returns on their 10-year bonds. They are not.
Recently, there's been many more negative surprises on economic reports than positive.
Jim Paulson is an investment strategist. He says you can see something else in these low bond returns.
The bond market is taking out a little bit of their inflation expectation.
Remember, investors who are putting their money in a 10-year-long treasury investment, they don't want that eaten up by inflation. So if they think inflation is going to be a problem, they're going to demand higher returns. Again, they're not. Data suggests inflation is not a thing right now.
You know, you look at commodity prices and oil being down. You look at weaker consumer price index reports. We just got a weak wage report, the last jobs number.
The other thing to keep in mind about why 10-year bond returns in the U.S. are so low is that they're kind of low everywhere. Wayne Schmidt is with Gradient Investments.
You know, the United States actually looks very attractive when you compare us to other countries around the world.
So in the U.S., you can say, sure, the economy is good enough for the Fed to change low rates to slightly less low rates. But anything more to see here than that? High growth, high inflation, bond market says no. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, by which I mean equities, since we just did bonds. Couple of blips after the Fed announcement came out, but mostly steady as she goes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are some new numbers out today on retail sales. Not great is the headline, down 0.3%, the biggest monthly decline in a year. Nobody was surprised. We've been reporting on retail's problems for a while now. Big department stores in particular have had it rough. But on the theory that it can't all be bad news, we asked Marketplace's Rima Crace where the sales silver linings might be.
Google retail apocalypse, and you'll find hundreds of articles telling you about hundreds of stores that are closing.
I'm so tired of reading about death rates.
Paula Rosenblum is a retail analyst with RSR Research. She says, look at the birth rates. Since last year, about 5,000 stores have closed, but almost as many have opened. She says if it were up to her, this is how she'd rewrite those headlines.
Retail sales continue to improve year over year. Consumer confidence at a high.
She says retail sales are improving thanks to a few sectors like grocery stores. The European grocery chain Lidl plans to open as many as 600 stores here. And she says Trader Joe's and Publix are doing well because
they're making the most convenient customer experience they can and keeping their prices sharp.
Sales for home goods are also expected to rise as more millennials set up their own homes. That's according to retail analyst Jeff Roster of IHL Consulting. He says it's critical that more retailers cater to this group.
Gen Z and the millennials, these are people that have come of age during the last Great Recession, and so they are all about value.
And nothing says value like discount stores.
If you look at who's adding stores, it's all the discounters. Dollar General, Walmart, Zara.
But the moment that fast fashion companies like Zara and H&M are experiencing may be short-lived, says retail analyst Sucharita Mulpuru.
Once you've already opened every store that you can possibly open, there's not going to be much room for growth.
And she says for other retailers, their headlines could be less gloomy if they focus more on value and the customer experience. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Five officials in the state of Michigan are facing charges of involuntary manslaughter for their role in the Flint water crisis. The state cut its subsidies for that state's water in March, leaving residents to pay for it at one of the highest rates in the country with state-funded filters for their homes, it should be said. Though the city's water now does meet federal standards for lead and copper, the system overall still needs an expensive overhaul, and the longer-run costs are as yet unclear. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
As the legal battle plays out, Flint is still fixing its water system. It's in the process of replacing around 20,000 lead and lead-tainted pipes. In 2014, the city had changed its water source to more corrosive river water, which caused lead to leach from pipes into the drinking water. It'll take the city years to complete the repairs. As for paying those costs?
The city really is in no position to fund anything.
That's Democratic U.S. Congressman Dan Kildee. His district includes Flint. He says Flint is broke. The money to mitigate the crisis so far has come from the state, $250 million, and from special federal appropriations, another $300 million. Kildee says those funds have paid for things like years of bottled water, then filters, plus expanded health care coverage, and some fixes to the water system. But he says more funding is needed, including for things like ongoing health monitoring.
It would help children who will have brain development issues as a result of high exposure to lead, to provide them the additional support they will need to overcome that hurdle.
Peter Munig, a professor in health policy and management at Columbia University, says Flint children's exposure to lead and other toxins will mean shorter lifespans and cognitive damage. He puts future costs at $400 million.
There would be increased welfare costs and decreased tax revenues from, lower incomes.
Costs, he says, that far exceed any savings that were achieved when the city changed up its water source. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
You know how you used to hear and read a lot of stories about the calculations people were making about whether to buy a house or just keep on renting? You don't hear quite so many of them nowadays, do you? That's because for more and more of us, it's not a choice. Despite years of record low interest rates and a healthier economy, every year fewer people can afford to buy a median-priced home. Millions fewer people. And that, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, is changing the way one huge part of the housing market works.
It's a hot Saturday morning, and members of the Las Vegas Runners Group are trickling into Grouchy John's coffee shop. Before long, the funky, art-filled space is full of sweaty and winded locals reviewing their runs over coffee and pastries.
So 7.3 miles round. We started here in the park and we finished here.
That's Christy Macer. When she's not running, she works as a banquet server in Vegas. She's been renting a condo not far off the strip and would like to buy a house. But so far, no luck.
It's ridiculous.
And she thinks she knows why.
A lot of people from out of town are coming in just to buy up the rental properties for income properties, and they're paying cash. They'd rather take a cash buyer than somebody who needs to finance.
Some of those investors are actually big companies, like Invitation Homes and American Homes for Rent, which have been snapping up houses since the financial crisis and turning them into rentals. So far, these kinds of investors control just a tiny slice of the market, a few hundred thousand homes nationwide. But compared to most individual real estate investors, their holdings are huge. And now, these corporate landlords may be getting a boost from the government.
This is the first time Fannie Mae has provided financing for institutional single-family rental properties.
That's Lori Goodman of the Urban Institute. Fannie Mae is a government agency that backs mortgages for investors and homeowners. Goodman is referring to the billion-dollar deal it recently did with Invitation Homes, which owns almost 50,000 homes in more than a dozen markets. Until now, Fannie capped investors at 10 homes. Jeffrey Hayward heads up the multifamily unit at Fannie Mae.
So if the market decides it wants to be a rental market, we have a thriving rental finance business, and we want to be there to serve low, middle, moderate workforce.
Hayward says the Invitation deal is a learning opportunity for Fannie Mae, which will have access to the company's data.
We should have a real sense of what it costs to operate these properties, what some of the best management practices are, so that you could set standards for expanding as the single-family rental ownership market changes.
But one agency's teachable moment is another group's idea of corporate welfare. Julia Gordon is with the National Community Stabilization Trust, which brings together financial institutions and community developers to help repair blighted neighborhoods.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac can lend really inexpensively because we, the taxpayers, stand behind them. That advantage should be used to help the people who are not being helped by the private sector.
Yet, Gordon recognizes the deal could do some good if it helps Fannie find ways to bring down the costs of renting.
What I hope it means is that they've used this deal to figure out how to work productively in the single-family rental space, and that they'll use that learning to go forward and work to support more affordability.
Affordability. Christy Macer could get used to a little of that. Back at the coffee shop, she says she's so frustrated with her marathon house hunt.
I've lost hope. It's disheartening.
But she's going to keep looking and wait for the prices and competition to eventually die down. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we'll fill more barrels this year than we have since 1976.
Bourbon is booming bootlegging, too. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On Fed Day, the Dow Industrials up 46 points, about 0.2%, ended things at 21,374. NASDAQ down 25, about 0.4% there, 61.94. S&P 500 fell 2 points, about a 0.1%, 24.37. Got to tell you, though, most of the day, they were just treading water. Retail stocks dipped after new government figures showed people spent less last month, as Rima Crace was telling us. Best Buy worsened 0.6%. Kohl's off 1%. Whole Foods down 0.4%. Today, lower oil prices hit energy stocks, as tends to happen. Halliburton slipped 2.2%. Valero Energy gave up 2.2%. Marathon Petroleum slowed 3%. Today, tax preparer H&R Block increased 7.9% after fourth quarter earnings beat analysts' expectations. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note went the opposite way of the Fed, down to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Television, as we all know by now, isn't just on TV anymore. Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and YouTube available on the device of your choice. We are watching stuff in more ways than ever. Kathleen Grace used to run the YouTube space here in Los Angeles. She is now the CEO of one of the studios that makes stuff for all practically all of those platforms I just mentioned. It's called New Form Digital. Kathleen, thanks for coming in.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Just as a place to start, how different is producing digital content from producing straight-up linear television, say, 10 years ago?
It's profoundly different because you have to think about what are all the ways we're going to find audience around this story, and then how are we going to engage with them? Mm-hmm. You know, traditional linear television was just a feed, and you could know at least some of the audience would be there because you were on a network.
Right.
You can't say that even if you're on Netflix. Your audience has to actively come find you. And so you have to constantly put in out hooks for them to come into the conversation. And then finally, you have to remember that every platform you're on, there's one thing they do no matter what every week. They push code. They change the game. And so you have to be aware of that. You know, and that's from me learning my experience at YouTube.
Yeah.
Every week, no matter what, YouTube pushes code. And that can impact your content.
To explain for those who are not versed in this, when you say pushing code, they move a button. They tweak something.
They
do something.
They change how the thumbnails appear.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, for the user, is like, now what do I do?
Yeah. User is like, great, that's
exactly what I wanted. Right.
For the content producer,
it's like, are you kidding me?
Are you really? I just figured out how to do my thumbnails.
Right.
But what I think it lets us do is that we get to experiment and do things quickly. So we saw vertical video was kind of emerging as a new format.
Literally holding your phone vertically, right?
Yeah. Instagram, you know, on Snapchat. And so we developed a pilot with that in mind. And so to me, it's just more and more opportunities to tell stories in different ways.
Hmm. With the added challenge now of you being in the front office of having to make money doing this.
Yes. That's also
explain.
That is also one of the more interesting parts. You know, when we launched the company, we had basically 3 to 4 buyers in mind. It was Yahoo, MSN.
Wow, Yahoo.
Like, we had conversations about, like, Yahoo's doing original programming.
Sorry. Yeah, coming the week that sale closes.
I know. And then within the first 6 months, YouTube Red started their initiative of funding content. We heard about Go 90.
Mm-hmm.
We heard about Vessel, which
Verizon,
is now
right?
come and gone.
Well, heard about Go 90 from Verizon, which is not doing well, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah. I think people cannot underestimate how hard it is to launch a video platform. And people cannot underestimate what an advantage both Netflix and YouTube have with their decade head start. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Netflix built a consumer base on DVD mailing and have a huge head start. They already have your credit card.
Mm-hmm.
That's half the battle, getting the credit card. And then YouTube built the most influential video platform in the history of mankind. Like, it's extraordinary what they did.
So far.
But they did that in 10 years, and then they started thinking about original programming.
So what keeps you up at night then? What's your worst nightmare?
That the audience, myself included, don't necessarily want to pay for content.
Yeah.
They don't want ads.
So interesting you said myself included.
And myself included. Like, I just cut my cable.
Oh,
I have Hulu TV,
and
that's all we do, and we love it. But the audience, I don't think, understands that content needs to be paid for, and we haven't found the right way to engage them around it.
So as you look out, I want to say 10, but that's a really long time in this landscape. So as you look out 3 to 5 years, what does the future of digital content and your space, the space in which you work, what does that look like? Is it like cable TV, or is it something else, or we don't know yet? Or is it 3 years is a really long time?
3 years is a really long time. I will say things that will continue to matter is story.
Yeah.
The second thing is the audience wins. Whoever has the audience wins. I think the biggest challenge over the next 3 years that people need to solve is discovery.
Finding it, that thing you were talking about earlier.
Finding it.
Yeah.
And not even just because I want everyone to find our shows, but I want to be able to find shows better as a viewer. And that, to me, is really interesting.
Kathleen Grace at New Form, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We cover secondary markets from time to time on this program, especially in-demand tickets for sporting events is the classic example. See also StubHub. We did one the other day on the buying and selling of phone numbers within the 212 area code, that most prestigious, for certain Manhattanites anyway, set of digits. A story now about another booming secondary market, one that in different times might well have been called bootlegging. Here's Marketplace's Adam Allington.
In the world of brown spirits, you can't get hotter than bourbon right now.
We'll fill more barrels this year than we have since 1976.
Chris Comstock is brand manager at Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky. Kentucky distilleries filled a whopping 1.9 million barrels last year, an increase of 315% since 2000. And some of Trace's most sought-after brands, such as George T. Stagg, which retails for $80, are now selling for north of $500 on the secondary market.
It's flattering, but we don't want to jack up the price just because the popularity of some of these brands is high today. We want to be fair.
But fair isn't a factor on the black market. And while it's illegal to sell alcohol without a license, thousands of people do it. People like a guy Will called James. James says most of what he buys is for his own use. He participates in about 6 to 10 Facebook groups that buy and sell. But then there are the flippers, people who go from store to store snapping up rare bottles and then selling them online at a huge markup.
I've seen people taking pictures, sitting in their car. They've had the bottle for 5 minutes, and they're already posting it up.
Other places to buy and sell include Craigslist and Reddit. James says he didn't get into the black market to make money, but he's not opposed to it either.
If I walked into a liquor store and there was a retail bottle and I knew I could sell it for 10 times what I paid for it, it wouldn't be a hard decision to do.
These black markets are creating havoc up and down the whiskey supply chain. Distillers don't like them because they don't see the profits on the markup. Stores don't like them either because they deal with the frustrated customers. Stephen Shackleton runs Shorewood Liquors just outside Minneapolis.
Seven liquor stores in this particular market has actually requested to take my allocation away from me and to give to them. That's how bad it is. It's kind of funny, actually, but it's not funny to me. This is my livelihood.
When he does get a rare label, say a Pappy Van Winkle 20, which retails for about $125, Shackleton says he has a special condition before he'll agree to sell.
It's a handshake deal that I'm going to break that seal. I'm going to take a fingernail and break the foil. So that particular person or that particular bottle will not be able to resell in the secondary market.
Bourbon's history on the black market goes back to Prohibition. Still, it's not illegal to sell now, so what's creating this unmet demand?
It takes a long time to make 25-year-old whiskey.
Craig Garthwaite is a professor of strategy at Northwestern. He says it's not like distillers can travel back in time and put more bourbon in barrels to meet demand today. So for now, what we have is a supply shortage, just like we often see with other commodities.
A distinction here is that we don't have one basic source where you would trade these in some type of commodities market, which is what you have for a lot of these other products.
Jack Rose Dining Saloon in Washington, D.C. is a place where enthusiasts regularly fork over a couple hundred dollars for a single ounce of super rare bourbons. Bill Thomas is the owner.
You know, we've been fortunate enough to buy a lot of that stuff along the way over the last decade or so and see increases that are just beyond what we ever thought they would be.
You want to pull out some iconic bottles?
In his private collection, Thomas has bottles from long-gone distilleries, single-barrel labels, the kind of stuff collectors would give their eye teeth for. Still, Thomas says even these bottles will eventually be drank.
I think that's the way the average whiskey drinker is. I think when you get real enthusiasts together who love bourbon, the cost just goes out the window at that point. Hopefully you bought it long enough ago that you actually forgot what you paid for it.
The good news, says Thomas, is that there's still plenty of bottles under $100 that taste just as good as the Pappy Van Winkles of the world, even if they aren't as rare. I'm Adam Ellington for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a sign of the changing times at Fox News, and maybe, just maybe, hopefully, probably should say, given the non-business news events of the day in Washington, hopefully a change in the broader political and social conversation in this country. Gabe Sherman, who we've had on this program a couple of times talking about the late Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, is reporting today in New York Magazine that the broadcaster has dropped its fair and balanced marketing slogan as being too closely associated with Ailes. Again, hopefully, some changing times. Federal Reserve spoke today and the markets went, yeah, and the Dow up 46, about 0.2%. NASDAQ down 25, 0.4%. S&P 500 off 2 points, about 0.1% there as well. The 10-year Treasury yield fell no matter what the Fed says. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.